Well, let's talk about this. Buttermilk cabbage soup. We got pickled bologna, killed lettuce with bacon and ramp greens. Coming up tomorrow night, the Andersonville restaurant Big Jones is putting on a good old Appalachian dinner. Big Jones is a restaurant that focuses on Southern heirloom cooking. And tomorrow night, we're going to welcome cookbook author Ronnie Lundy to cook up some recipes from her new book, Vittles, An Appalachian Journey with Recipes. It's also a fundraiser for the Southern Foodways Alliance. So what is Appalachian cuisine and what flavors will we savor from tomorrow night's event? Joining me in studio, Big Jones, executive chef and co-owner Paul Fairbach. Paul, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Howdy, Justin. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Love your restaurant.
Thanks.
Let's talk about this. I mean, because this is, I mean, you, Big Jones is Southern heirloom cooking. What you're doing tomorrow is Appalachian cooking. Are they similar? I mean, are we talking about the same thing, just sort of different words?
Well, Appalachian cooking is sort of a subtext or a part of Southern regional cooking. And we like to cook, we have a regional focus at the restaurant. We do a lot of Louisiana cooking. We do a lot of low country cooking, but we do have some Appalachian dishes on the menu, and we take the same approach to them that we do to the rest of the Southern dishes that we do, which is to say, we think of our cuisine as heirloom cooking. And that means it's very ingredient driven.
Okay.
We like to have pure unadulterated ingredients like you would have had, you know, say 100 years ago or 150 years ago before industrial food and, you know, before Jell-O started popping up in all of the recipes and you know, canned ketchup, you know, started popping up in all the recipes. Like, what do you have if you are bringing raw produce into your kitchen and working with it? And, you know, that's what I really liked about Ronnie's book. And the stories in it are just marvelous, and it paints a picture of an Appalachia, I think, that most people don't realize.
Yeah, because, I mean, you think of Appalachia culture, there's a folk culture around it, mountain-type culture, but I don't necessarily think of food when I think of Appalachian culture, but it's a big part of it.
Yeah, which is interesting because a lot of foods that you would call iconic Southern dishes actually came down from the mountains. Fried chicken. Which I think a lot of people associate with Louisiana now, which is funny. That started in the mountains. That was freed black slaves who'd escaped slavery, and Germans bringing their Dutch ovens, and the Scotch bringing their tradition, and the African Americans had the tradition from West Africa of frying birds in hot oil, and the Spanish and the Scottish immigrants had a tradition of confiting and preserving chicken in pork fat, and the Germans had these Dutch ovens, and, you know, there's fried chicken, and next thing you know, it's all over the South. And the oldest fried chicken recipe we have endemic to the United States is from Mary Randolph's The Virginia Housewife, which was published in Richmond, Virginia, which is sort of on the fall line. So you start to think of the upcountry leading to the Appalachians. And that was in 1824 in Richmond, Virginia. So perhaps the most iconic Southern dish came from Appalachia.
You know, I also, I mean, when I think of some of the ingredients that you talk about, you know, or they're going to be featuring tomorrow, a lot of root vegetables, and obviously this is a kind of a transition time of the year because the more sort of greens and the produce will be coming at the end as spring begins. But talk about, you know, the role of the root vegetable and the produce in Appalachian cuisine.
Yeah, well, Ronnie and I, when we first started talking last summer about doing a dinner when her book came out, sort of focused on this time because it is a really cool time when you think about Appalachian cooking and the traditional nature of it, that right now you have the end of winter. You know, Appalachia is different from a lot of the South. It's certainly different from Louisiana or Charleston, where you have a winter, and it's a deep winter. So they developed a curing tradition, and you have salt pork. You have things like bacon. And you have things like country ham.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
And you have root vegetable storage crops, but you also have ferments, things like sauerkraut, which people don't necessarily think
which
of as Appalachian.
Featured, their kraut will be featured tomorrow.
Yeah, and that was a big deal. That was how you survived in the winter up there. And, you know, so we really like this idea of doing this dinner right now at this time where, you know, you're sort of using up the last of those ferments, but after that long winter, and after eating all of this delicious salt pork all winter and all of these ferments, you're just so hungry for something green and fresh.
Well, the food tells a story.
Right. And the first things that come up are ramps and morels. And so they'll figure pretty prominently tomorrow
night.
All
right. So tell me about the ramp, because I know that's part of the onion family, but I'm not familiar with ramps as much as I would say, like, you know, onions.
Well, ramps are one of the most abundant wild foods in the United States in the eastern woodlands. So, I mean, I used to run into them all the time when I would just go hiking out in the woods. Usually, and in fact, I first really discovered morels as a forageable thing when I was out looking for, not morels, looking for, I discovered ramps as a forageable thing looking when I was morels, out looking yeah. for morels. And on the way to the morels, you find the ramp, you know, you stumble upon a ramp patch. You're like, this smells like an onion. And you go back and ask Dad, what's this? And it's like, oh, that's a, you know, that's an onion. And so, but ramps are very important because they're, you know, certainly in the case of a traditional farming culture in Appalachia was a lot of, you know, families on small subsistence farms. That becomes very important because it's essentially free. You go out and you forage it and you can cook it and it's nutrition. So they're a very important food in
what's
in
the
that
taste?
Tradition.
What's the, I mean, is it, it's an onion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could think of like an onion has a spicy or a sharp, like a sharp taste. It or like a ramp stings. It's like even more potent. It's somewhere, you know, in terms of the heat scale, it's somewhere between an onion and say like a red onion and garlic. But it's also sort of in between an onion and garlic on the funk factor. It's kind of funky. it tastes like, you know, they have a little bit of a taste of the humus on the forest floor like that. Which, you know, if you grew up in the country like I do, is a beautiful sweet smell. But I think a lot of city slickers can
they may not like to
be
funk,
taken aback right? by it at first.
In studio with me tonight, Chef Paul Fehrbach. He is the executive chef, co-owner of Big Jones, the restaurant in Andersonville. Tomorrow night, a big event. They're celebrating Appalachian cuisine with an Appalachian dinner with cookbook author Ronnie Lundy. Her book, Vittles, An Appalachian Journey with Recipes, is out. They're going to be cooking from the book. It's going to be at the restaurant. You can find out more information at BigJonesChicago.com. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do a little bit more. I'm fascinated on, you know, as a restaurant that is an heirloom restaurant where you need to do pure ingredients. You know, you're at the whim of local produce of the seasons. We kind of talked about the idea of you kind of being in between. So even beyond Appalachian cuisine, how you as a chef deal with, you know, the ingredients coming when they come. There's no way to manufacture that. Chef in studio. We'll take a quick break. Come back. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Chef Paul Fehrbach. He is the executive chef and co-owner of Big Jones in Andersonville, Southern Heirloom Cooking. Tomorrow night, Ronnie Lundy, the cookbook author, her book, Vittles, An Appalachian Journey with Recipes. Ronnie is going to be up at Big Jones along with Chef Fehrbach, and they're going to be cooking some of the recipes, a big event. Tickets available, BigJonesChicago.com. You know, I think about Appalachian food and we, you know, right before the break, I kind of teased out the question of, you know, for you working in, explaining what heirloom cooking is, the idea of working with pure ingredients and not using any canned or anything that might be synthetic or jello, as you said, you know, you're at the whim of seasons. I mean, you just kind of mentioned that here comes the spring, you know, we're entering the winter. How do you have to adjust to that as a chef? I mean, the idea that you can only use certain ingredients at certain times in Chicago.
Yeah, that was actually an interesting part of the restaurant's history, in my own history. But one of the things that really sort of blew up Big Jones, certainly on the local scene, but also to some extent on the national scene, at least in the Southern dining circles, was this idea of the historic dishes that we do. And sometimes we'll put, you know, dates on dishes. And that sort of came about because when I decided that I was going to cook, you know, how my great grandparents did in their little farm kitchen. And, you know, I don't have a freezer. There's no freezer. You know, my dry goods pantry is limited. I'm going to do all of my own preserving. I'm going to do all of my own meat curing. You know, how do I deal with seasons? And that was a really hard question. And I found myself digging into old cookbooks, looking for different, you know, different approaches. So I gathered up every Southern focused primarily, but, you know, also Midwestern cookbooks that were dated before, you know, say every house had a freezer, you know, in the 1950s. And I found a lot of interesting dishes, you know, dating all the way back to the beginning of the country and, you know, things that had been sort of forgotten. But I also say well, you know, a dish like the way we do chicken and dumplings is like my great grandma did. And, you know, she made it exact in 1920, exactly like I do. So we put that date on the menu. I mean, so you're having that taste of history. Wow. And I think one of the keys when you talk about heirloom cooking, whether it's heirloom Southern cooking or heirloom Midwestern cooking or what have you, is that connection to your ancestors of the taste. And it requires the right ingredients and it requires the right preparation methods. But taste is a way you can link to your past and link to your ancestors.
I was going to say, being a chef in this discipline, you essentially are part chef, part historian. I mean, you have to think about what came before you and research and have the skills to be able to do that.
Yeah, and it's fun though for me because I love history. I always have. It's, you know, even when I was a kid in school, I was the nerd that was reading the history book before.
You're supposed to, right?
I would read the whole thing by like the second week of class because it's just been a fascinating subject for me. So it's, you know, I didn't set out when we started Big Jones, we wanted to have a good Southern restaurant like you would find in the South, in a, you know, on Magazine Street in New Orleans or on King Street in Charleston, and, you know, not fine dining, but, you know, nice farm to table food. And it has evolved as a reflection of the way I think and the way I approach, you know, life, which is always with a strong eye on history. And we're obviously moving forward, but for me to move forward requires that sort of that eye on the past.
You know, but doing this event tomorrow and really sort of focusing on Appalachian cuisine, you think about the history of that community here in Chicago. I mean, you're in Andersonville. It's not too far from as we were talking about, Uptown, which was a place where a lot of Appalachians settled here in Chicago. Talk about that. Talk about understanding where communities sort of come and go when it pertains to food.
Yeah, Chicago has a long and intimately intertwined history with Southern communities, with New Orleans and jazz, with the Delta and blues, with the Illinois Central Railroad and the Great Migration. But there was also during the Great Depression and also after the war in the 1950s, there was a huge migration of Appalachians, mostly white Southerners, to the northern industrial cities for jobs. And my grandma left the country outside Bristol, Tennessee, and wound up in Detroit, which is where my mom grew up, as part of that migration. Yeah. And Chicago had a huge Appalachian community. It was called the Appalachian Ghetto in Uptown today, and people brought their cooking with them. And there were restaurants, you know, there were Southern restaurants in Chicago then. And, you know, I guess maybe in the 70s and 80s, there became less and less as we sort of...
Yeah, I was going to say, why don't you see more of that inspired cuisine in Chicago?
I think you're starting to see more of them now, but there was this really strange thing that happened, I think, across the country in the 70s and 80s, was this sort of fetishization of, you know, French and or continental fine dining cuisine, which was not seasonal. You know, why bother, you know, learning how to cook differently in the winter when you can just get asparagus from Peru and put a hollandaise sauce on it? And, you know, in California, in the 1980s, things started to sort of move, progress in a different direction with Alice Waters and all of the stuff she was doing. But the rest of the country was still stuck in the dark ages. And, you know, so there was, you know, the 70s and 80s, I think, for most of America, were some pretty dark ages.
And you still see that today. I mean, that's somewhat the roots of what we see with our fine dining organizations or restaurants here in Chicago.
You do see it, but more and more. I mean, I think that to the extent that you do see it, it's in the more institutionalized restaurants that are really, really big and serve a lot of covers, and they have very institutionalized operations that are difficult to change. Certainly the small independent restaurants that are opening to a large extent, there's more and more restaurants that are cooking from the market to the table.
Is there ever a time when you're like, why did I choose to do it this way? I mean, if I could just get my hands on some hollandaise sauce, you know, like is there ever a time where you're like, you know, I love the history of it. I love the concept of cooking heirloom and going sort of, you know, the history part of it. But you know what? Maybe I can cut some corners.
Well, it's certainly a lot of work to do it the way we do. And, you know, we think all the time about, well, you know, maybe we should stop processing our own hogs, because that takes 2 days. That's basically 2 days of work, to, you know, to make the, to fabricate the bacon and the ham and the pork chops and the, you know, and then they have to have a space to cure in refrigeration for, you know, anywhere from a week to a month, depending on whether it's bacon, ham, or tasso. But then, you know, you taste it and you think, wow, this is, you know, you can't get this product anywhere else in the world. And, you know, that to me is a tremendous value that we can provide to our guests.
All right, for tomorrow night, is there one dish for you as a chef as you get ready for this event, one Appalachian dish that you're like, I cannot wait to dig into? I cannot wait to create, and I cannot wait to serve to the audience.
Can I give you two?
Yes.
That buttermilk cabbage soup is Ronnie Lundy is already kind of legendary in some circles. I mean, for that soup. It's really amazing. It's something you would never think of, and you put it in your mouth and you're like, oh my God, you know, it's like crawfish etouffee, you know, crawfish and butter, or, you know, peanut butter and jelly or whatever great food combination you like. It's one of those things. And the other one is this banana pudding, which the recipe she uses in her book is from, Ian Bowden, my friend who has a restaurant in Staunton, Virginia, which is this little town up in the mountains. Doing food that would be, you know, top flight in Chicago in this little mountain town. But he does this, that makes this sweet, it's called sweet and savory banana pudding. And we made this miso banana bread for it. It uses red miso, and it's salty and it's savory and it's sweet. And, you know, that's sort of one of the layers in this banana pudding. And, we made the vanilla wafers homemade and all of that. And that's going to be really something.
Well, Ronnie Lundy will be, her cookbook will be used tomorrow night. Vittles, an Appalachian Journey with Recipes, will be part of the fundraiser for the Southern Foodways Alliance up at Big Jones in Andersonville. The executive chef and co-owner Paul Fehrbach is my guest tonight. The Vittles, an Appalachian Dinner with Ronnie Lundy starts at 6 o'clock. And tickets are available at BigJonesChicago.com. Chef, thanks so much for coming in, and can't wait to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Justin.